concerted effort, you know, by whomever. But we do know also of J. Edgar Hoover. And they were trying everything. The Mann Act, of course, you know, transporting a woman across the state line. The woman was my mother, his wife. Of course, she wasn't my mother yet at that point in time, but she was his wife. They were looking at him for tax evasion, you know, and they were looking at him about the Black Star Line, which was his signature economic project to trade between Africa, the Caribbean, and the United States. So, again, you know, the whole idea was a political trial to destroy him and hence destroy the movement.
Have you heard from the White House?
No, we have not heard back anything from the White House.
Well, we're going to do part two of this fascinating discussion of your father, Marcus Garvey's life, in a post-show discussion, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. Dr. Julius Garvey is a cardiothoracic and vascular surgeon who's leading the Justice for Garvey effort, seeing a posthumous presidential pardon for his father, the civil rights leader, Marcus Garvey. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Main Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nardina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. Portland weather. Patchy fog before 10, 40% chance of rain after 1 o'clock, after 1 this afternoon, with a high near 43. Coming up at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, Amy S. Foster, author of The Rift Uprising, tune in to hear her thoughts about military deception, treatment of immigrants, and the bewildering new adult genre popping up in bookstores. Up next, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Joanne is going to be on the phone with the author of Stop and Frisk, The Use and Abuse of a Controversial Police Tactic. That's next on KBOO.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a new member and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It is my pleasure to talk with Michael D. White. He's a professor of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Arizona State University and is associate director of ASU's Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety. He is also a senior diagnostic specialist for the Office of Justice Programs Diagnostic Center and a senior subject matter expert for the Bureau of Justice Assistance Smart Policing Initiative. He received his PhD in criminal justice from Temple University in 1999, and prior to entering academia, Dr. White worked as a deputy sheriff in Pennsylvania. Dr. White's primary research interests involved the police, including use of force, technology, and misconduct. His recent work has been published in Justice Quarterly, Criminology and Public Policy, Criminal Justice and Behavior and Crime and Delinquency. He is co-author of Jammed Up, Bad Cops, Police Misconduct, and the New York City Police Department, and co-editor of Race, Ethnicity, and Policing, New and Essential Readings, both published by New York University Press. Dr. White has commented extensively in the media on police officers' body-worn cameras, including in Scientific America, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, et cetera. Dr. White is currently conducting a multi-state randomized control trial testing the impact of police officers' body-worn cameras. He is also author of the U.S. Department of Justice report titled Police Officer Body-Worn Cameras, Assessing the Evidence. I want to thank you and welcome you, Dr. Michael White, to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Joanne.
It is absolutely my pleasure. And I should say that your most recent publication is Stop and Frisk, the Use and Abuse of a Controversial Police Tactic, that you co-authored with Henry Fardella?
That is correct, yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here. But now that I know so much about your background, I have so many more questions. I think the book is absolutely fascinating because it really does go through the history of how policing has happened in America. And so let's just jump right in. First, why this book?
You know, Joanne, one of the things that that had kind of bugged me over the last few years was that I had heard in a number of different forums people using the term stop and frisk and racial profiling as if they were synonyms, as if they were the same thing, and it just didn't resonate with me based on my, you know, my educational training, based on my training in law enforcement. A couple of decades ago, I understood stop and frisk to be a constitutionally approved and valid technique. So as I heard in the media, and I heard politicians and other advocacy groups using these two terms and just assuming that stop and frisk is racial profiling, that really it didn't make much sense to me. So, at the time, NYU Press came to me and asked me if I would delve into this in terms of writing a book. So I seized that opportunity to kind of explore this disconnect that was happening, in terms of what I understood the principles of stop and frisk to be and how it had been morphed and kind of bastardized into this new type of program that consistently kind of diverged into racial profiling.
And so that's a perfect place to start. I mean, there's just so much to talk about in this short hour that we have. And so your initial thought was, so why are people connecting these two, right? One is a tactic used by police departments and one is unconstitutional, right? And the two shouldn't necessarily be intertwined. So what did you find?
Well, the first thing is that stop and frisk as a police tactic absolutely 100% is constitutionally approved. You can look at several Supreme Court cases. The big set of cases occurred in the late 60s. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case called Terry v. Ohio, in which they essentially memorialized the authority for officers to engage in stop and frisk as long as they have reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. But actually, you can look at, if you look at things historically, you can trace the authority of the police to stop citizens, to detain them and question them. You can trace that back hundreds of years, all the way back into English common law.
And if we could, because I want to make sure that our listening audience really understands the court's reasoning. And so in the Terry v. Ohio case, the officers alleged that based on their observation and their years of police work, they assumed that Terry was up to a criminal activity. And so when they approached him, the goal was to make sure, quote unquote, that the police officer was safe, right? And so they patted the outside pockets and then found firearms. Right? Is that the right case?
That's the right one.
Okay.
And, you know, before this case, if you look at the Constitution of the United States, the Fourth Amendment, is what deals with search and seizure, which is, you know, the core of what we're talking about here. Yes. With stop and frisk. And the Fourth Amendment talks about probable cause. You have to have probable cause to search somebody.
Right.
And in the Terry case, the officer McFadden, he observed Terry as well as two other individuals engaged in what he believed to be suspicious behavior. He thought they were casing a robbery store for a jewelry store for a later robbery, excuse me. And at the time when he witnessed that behavior, he did not have probable cause.
Right.
But despite that, he did approach them, he did detain them, he questioned them, and during that questioning, he conducted, as you said, a superficial pat-down on the outer clothing, and at that point discovered two firearms. He then arrested Terry and his counterparts, and then during the criminal prosecution, Terry's attorney then challenged the evidence, the seizure of the firearms, based on not having probable cause. So this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it was then that the U.S. Supreme Court established this new lower standard of evidence called reasonable suspicion, and said it's important for police to have the authority to investigate suspected criminal activity, even if it hasn't reached the level of probable cause, because they need to be able to prevent crime and they need to be able to stop crime that is about to be committed.
Right. And so fast forward. So this was in the 70s, is that right?
The ruling was 1968, yes.
68. Okay. And so fast forward. So this was about officer safety and preventing crime from taking place if possible, right? That was the Supreme Court's response. So fast forward to New York City, say 2000, right, where more than 600,000 people were being stopped and frisked yearly. And it was actually part of what was recommended, but that's too soft. That was required through the roll calls and through directives from New York police supervisors to the police officers that were working on the street. Right. So that's, you know, so we talk about in a 30-year time period, the premise from what the court said is compared to how it played out on the street. Would you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, and the other thing I should mention is, so as we discussed, the original ruling in Terry was in 1968. There were a number of other court cases that that were heard before the Supreme Court from that point moving forward, in which the Supreme Court continually reaffirmed the authority of police to engage in stop and frisk, and in fact expanded in some ways.
Yeah, they did expand it pretty much any time a case made it to the Supreme Court. But I'm sorry, I interrupted.
That's right. So then we fast forward to New York City in the early 1990s, and New York City, you know, it was a very different city than it is now in terms of crime. Crime was very prevalent. There was a lot of social and physical disorder. I think it was in 1991. There were 2,000 homicides in the city of New York. So it was a very different place than the New York we know now. And in fact, Rudy Giuliani became mayor in 1994. He was elected primarily on a platform to get tough on crime. So he hires William Breton as commissioner of the NYPD, and they set about targeting the significant amount of crime that was occurring, and two particular types of crime that they were interested in reducing were illegal gun carrying and drug possession. And what happened is they focused on stop and frisk as a particularly effective tactic to address those two types of crime, the illegal gun carrying and the drug possession. Right. And then what happened is throughout the 90s, the reliance on stop and frisk increased every year, and then, you know, by the 1999 was the first time we had some concerns raised about the tactic. The Attorney General for the state of New York issued a report raising concerns about officers engaging in stop and frisk without that evidentiary requirement of reasonable suspicion, and then the litigation started, and there was more than a decade of litigation in federal court where the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU were challenging the NYPD's use of stop and frisk. Despite that litigation, which started in the early 2000s, the NYPD continued to rely heavily on stop and frisk. And then by 2011, that was the peak year, the NYPD stopped more than 685,000 citizens. And what's important to recognize is those stops were not evenly distributed across the five boroughs of New York City. They were heavily concentrated in primarily low-income, high-crime, minority neighborhoods, which was in large part the result of the litigation, or the cause of the litigation, because the Center for Constitutional Rights was alleging that essentially the NYPD was applying this tactic in a way that was racially discriminatory.
And so it stopped in New York because I know why it stopped, but if you would be so kind as to tell our listeners, it ultimately came to an end, and because of a court decision.
That's right. The Floyd versus City of New York case, and this was the litigation I had just referred to, things finally came to a head, and there was a trial in federal court in front of a federal judge in which both the defendant, the NYPD, and the City of New York, as well as the plaintiff, made their case. They presented their case, and then in August of 2013, the federal judge issued her ruling, in which she essentially concluded that the NYPD's program was racially discriminatory, and ordered the department to stop the use of stop and frisk as they were using it as this kind of mass surveillance program in minority neighborhoods, and then she ordered a series of remedies for the department to employ that would continue to improve their strategy and kind of wean them off of the use of stop and frisk. And it was really, although if you look at the numbers that the NYPD had started to pull back in 2012 and 2013, but last year, the number of stop and frisk, I mentioned there were 685,000
right.
stop and frisk in 2011. Last year, there were it was under 30,000. So we're talking on the order of a 90% decline in reliance on stop and frisk in just a period of a few years.
Wow, that's pretty significant. Now, I was under the impression, and maybe I have this wrong, but I thought that the reason that stop and frisk came to a halt in New York was because that police officers were able to record being directed to go out and stop black and brown people for enhanced enforcement using the stop and frisk tactic. And because there were police officers that recorded it, that was then able to feed into the court case, which actually then declared it unconstitutional. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there was a number of things that were presented at that Floyd trial that convinced the judge that the NYPD's program was unconstitutional, and officers testified during the trial, and a couple of things became clear. One was that that they were being ordered to essentially have to follow a quota system in terms of the number of stops that they were engaged in. It also became clear that the training was not sufficient. Officers didn't have a good understanding of what reasonable suspicion meant. And then the primary expert, Dr. Jeff Fagan from Columbia University, presented an analysis which essentially, in my mind, established fairly clearly the unconstitutionality of the program. But there were a number of things that were presented at trial that were pretty persuasive in terms of making the case that the NYPD's program was unconstitutional.
So if you're just joining in, I am talking to Dr. Michael D. White. He is the co-author of Stop and Frisk, The Use and Abuse of a Controversial Policing Tactic. And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Dr. White, another question that I have, I love the fact that you have been a consultant with the Department of Justice. We in Oregon are now not under a consent decree. We're under a settlement with because Portland police officers were found to use excessive force with people who either had or were perceived to have mental health issues. And so in your role working with the Department of Justice, doing this analysis kind of across the country, what are you seeing as the fundamental challenge to having constitutionally appropriate policing throughout the United States?
It's an excellent question, Joanne. So there are two ways that a police department can find themselves basically under the authority of a federal court. One is the type of case that we've seen in New York City, where basically a private citizen or in this case, an advocacy group sues the department and basically files a class action lawsuit under Section 1983, and then a federal court rules in favor against the police department and then applies remedies. The second is the what you're experiencing in Portland, which is essentially where the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice comes in, conducts an investigation, and then makes a determination that the department is engaged in a pattern or practice of police misconduct, and then as a result of that, you have the agreement or the consent decree that Portland is under now. Essentially, then the department agrees to work with the federal court and a monitor to implement remedies that will eliminate the unconstitutional policing that's occurred. And the Civil Rights Division has been pretty active over the last several years. The departments that have been investigated recently include Chicago, Ferguson, Baltimore. So these are departments that have had very high-profile misconduct cases. So those are the two ways that the federal court can get involved. And the types of things I think that are targeted in consent decrees, it's usually not just one or two kind of rogue officers. What the federal court finds in this. The Civil Rights Division finds is that there are deficiencies that go to the very core of the police department in terms of training, in terms of supervision, and in terms of administrative policy. And those are the things that typically have to be addressed over a period of several years in a consent decree before the department can be released from that consent decree.
Right. I know here our experience has been really mixed. I think there was a community effort that actually invited the Department of Justice to town, and the Department of Justice did an effective job of reaching out and talking to a broad range of the community, of course, with community help, when they did their investigation. However, when they came up with the solution to what they found, the community was totally shut out of that process. And so what we have now is a settlement agreement that most of the community believes doesn't actually fix the fundamental problems within the police bureau. So, for example, if the Department of Justice says the problem is that you're using excessive force with people with mental health issues or perceived to have mental health issues, and then the Department of Justice solution was, well, let's train the police officers to be first responders for people with mental health issues, right? And so as a community member, there seems to be a disconnect. Because our preference would be to have mental health professionals as first responders as compared to police. But that's kind of what we're doing here in Oregon. And so you've also done some extensive investigation around body cams.
That's correct, yes.
And what conclusions have you come to about whether or not body cams serve the public?
I've been doing a fair amount of work, both independent research as an academic, but I also do a lot of consulting for the U.S. Department of Justice. I'm the co-director of training and technical assistance for the Department of Justice funding program. So USDOJ created a funding mechanism whereby police departments can write grants, and if they get the grant, then they receive funds to purchase body-worn cameras. And I am part of a team that provides training and technical assistance for any department in the country that gets federal money. And the point that I like to raise first about body cameras is that the train has left the station. I mean, thousands of police departments across the country have either adopted or are planning to adopt this technology. the challenge for researchers now is to try to catch up to answer some of the core questions about the technology, because there are a lot of claims that have been made by critics of body cameras as well as advocates about some of the concerns and problems as well as some of the benefits. And I can tell you we are catching up as researchers. There is a growing body of research that documents the positive effects of body cameras, and you see that in a number of different areas. Consistently, citizen complaints against police decline substantially after officers start wearing body cameras. In a number of police departments, use of force by officers has declined after officers start wearing body cameras. And we've seen in research that citizens are very supportive of the idea of officers wearing this technology. And in fact, I had done interviews with citizens in Spokane, Washington, and I conducted my interviews with citizens who actually had encounters with police, and those encounters were recorded. So these are citizens who had something bad happen to them.
Right.
As a result of that, the police responded. The police responded, and the officers who responded were wearing body cameras, and the encounter was recorded. And I interviewed those citizens anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks after that recorded encounter. And even citizens who had negative experiences and had police respond, they were very supportive of police officers wearing body cameras. So, there's still more work to be done, but the early kind of story on body cameras is that they do deliver on many of the benefits that people have described.
So the devil, as you know, is always in the details. Tell me about Spokane's policy on body cam. So who has access to the body cam footage?
Joanne, you touched on one of the primary issues right now that departments are facing, and that is, what does their administrative policy say on a range of different issues? A couple of the big issues are, when should officers activate the camera? Do they have to tell citizens that they're being recorded? And then, of course, on the back end, who gets to review the video? Officers are concerned about supervisors reviewing the video, kind of going on expeditions and trying to find fishing expeditions, that is, to try to find things to jam them up. But the issues of review of the footage also are, when does the officer get to review the footage? And then beyond the officer and police department, who in the community gets to review the footage? And I can tell you that in Spokane and in most other places in the country, officers have access to their video. So as an officer at the end of their shift is writing reports and or even maybe getting ready for court testimony, they generally have access to their video, and they can use their video to help them complete their reports and prepare for court testimony.
So I'm sorry, I want to be really clear about this, because this is a real sticky point here. So in Spokane, before an incident happens, do officers write a report after the incident, or do they write the report after they've reviewed the body cam?
In Spokane and most other places, they can review the video first. So they can review their body camera video as they're completing their report, as a way to refresh their memory, make sure they're writing an accurate report. Now,
I gotta stop you here.
Okay.
Because this is one of the ones that just kind of makes me crazed, right? And so, because police departments sell body cams to the public as a transparency tool, a tool that will reduce police violence and community violence, and it's a way to hold police departments accountable. Before body cams, police officers at the end of their shifts wrote reports. Now, the norm is becoming police officers get to review their video camera footage, and then based on what's in the video camera footage, they write their report. Now, I have a hard time with this refreshing their memory kind of thing, because they were there, right? And when we didn't have body cam footage or video, they didn't have any problems writing written reports based on their memory of what happened at that incident. And so please tell me why the public would invest millions of dollars in buying equipment that the public has no access to the, or even if they have, we haven't even gotten to the back end yet. We're still at, okay, something happens, and the police officers are now writing a report. So I need to understand why the public would spend millions of dollars to buy the equipment, and they have no, and it's not being used as an accountability tool. So I guess the question is, what is it being used as? Because it's not, it can't be accountability if the officers get to use it before they write their report.
Well, you just said a whole lot. So I'm
gonna try to wade
through this. You know, most departments have taken the position that the body-worn camera is, that it has evidentiary value, and that kind of routine reports that an officer would write at the end of the shift are more likely to be accurate if an officer has the ability to review footage of an incident. The other thing that you raise is the accountability issue. So there, you know, that gets to the question of how the department will use body-worn camera video to monitor police officer behavior. And I can tell you, I've reviewed a lot of police department policies on body cameras for agencies all across the country.
Right.
And the vast majority allow supervisors to go in and review video to make sure that officers are in compliance with the policy, and in many cases to review their performance. Certainly, almost all policies allow supervisors to go in and review body-worn camera footage for an incident where there's a citizen complaint, where an officer uses force. That's automatic. So it has accountability value, because on the back end, should something happen and a citizen's upset and files a complaint, the supervisor of the department just goes right to the video and says, okay, let's see what's happened. Is the citizen's allegation, does it have veracity? Did it happen? Is it accurate? Or is the citizen incorrect? And then if the citizen is accurate, the allegation actually did occur, then the officer, you know, can be disciplined in the appropriate way based on the nature of the transgression.
We have a caller on the line. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Sean, good morning, Sean. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Joanne. Good morning, Michael. Interesting, since I was listening, you guys were talking body cameras. Not the main reason I called. I just wanted to quickly point out that one of the big things that I've seen quite a few times happen with body cam is that for some reason, the camera doesn't work just before an incident happens. It either supposedly, you know, is said that it's broken or it's been shut off, and then, of course, it seems to work after the incident is over. So that's just one point I wanted to make. My main call for is to ask Michael is that, you know, speaking of mental health, and that is within the police departments, and that is the main issue and a big thing, is there is a kind of revolving door of a lot of ex-military that are hired into the police departments. And my question is there any type of serious vetting that goes on of fellows that come out of the military, men or women, who come into police forces after they've been in the military, considering there is a high rate of PTSD and problems with a lot of people coming straight out of war, basically, and going into police departments? And of course, there's racism within the military too. And how much all those issues of racism and mental health, and how police departments go about vetting people when they're looking to hire, and if that's been studied, and how that plays a part into the transaction of how police then deal with mental health issues when they're on the job?
Great question. Thank you for the call.
Thanks.
Michael?
Yeah, Sean, you actually had a number of different interesting things that you said there. I'll deal with the last point first, the question of military, you know, officers coming out of the military and then joining police departments. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, someone who's coming out of the military goes through the same selection process as someone who has not been in the military but has also applied for the police department. The one thing some departments will do is they will give preference to somebody with military background. In many cases, a department may have some sort of college degree requirement, whether it be an associate's degree or even possibly a four-year degree, and that can be waived in lieu of military service. But other than that, you know, someone who's coming out of the military who applies for a job in a police department will go through the same selection process. So issues related to PTSD or other mental health issues should be identified in that process in the same way that, you know, someone without military experience would be identified. And then generally speaking, those types of mental health issues result in exclusion from the applicant pool. That's the first point. And jumping to the body-worn camera point about activation and malfunction, I mean, there are a number of different reasons why a camera might not, why there might not be a video when there should be. One is that the officer activates and there's a malfunction. I mean, this is technology. Technology sometimes doesn't work. The more common reason, I think, is that the officer doesn't activate either intentionally or simply forgets. I think we need to keep in mind that especially veteran officers, they've been, you know, an officer who's been on the street and doing his job or her job for 20 years has never worn a body camera. It's not in their muscle memory. And then now they have one, and it's just there's going to be a learning curve in terms of kind of working that into their process.
So why would it not be standard to have it on at all times?
I've heard that question a lot. Why not just turn it on at the beginning of the shift and then keep it on for the 10 or 12 hour shift and then turn it off at the end? And it's just not reasonable. One of the reasons is cost, because you have to store all of the data that you record, and it has to be stored securely. And that's the really expensive part of body-worn cameras is the equipment. The cameras are not that expensive. On the back end, the real cost is the storing all of the data, and it has to be stored, as I said, securely, because it could be evidence in a criminal trial, civil trial, citizen complaint, you name it. And then just the resources in terms of managing the program. So what departments typically do is they'll create a policy that requires officers just to record encounters with citizens. And in a 10-hour shift, which is what most police officers work, generally, officers who are wearing body cameras will record anywhere from 2 to 4 hours of video.
So once again, this is a officer discretion kind of thing? I guess that's what puzzles me, because it sounds like it's kind of it's left to the officer's discretion. So when you say a citizen encounter, right? And so let's use an example. Stop and frisk is a great example of a citizen encounter. So in a case where in Portland, we call it mere conversation. So we don't even call it stop and frisk. But a police officer will walk up on an individual, do a little chit chat. Where are you going? Where are you been? Can I check your backpack? Can I check your pockets? Blah, blah, blah. And that's called mere conversation. In that situation, is that a citizen contact?
I would argue it is. And it sounds exactly like a stop and frisk.
Yes, it does.
The question a citizen should ask who's having one of those interactions is, am I free to leave? If the answer is yes, you're free to leave, then it's a consensual encounter and you can walk away as a citizen. If the officer says no, then your liberty is being curtailed at that point. You're in a stop and frisk. And the vast majority of police departments that have body-worn cameras, their policy would dictate that an officer record that type of encounter.
Well, you and I know how quickly an encounter can go from a mere conversation to a deadly encounter, right? So, again, it doesn't... I guess I'll back up. Is the Department of Justice working on some model policy that they would recommend police departments across the country adopt?
There are several model policies around, and in some cases they come from advocacy groups. So, for example, the ACLU has a national model body-worn camera policy. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, IACP, which is the big kind of umbrella organization for police leaders in the United States and abroad, they have their own policy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the U.S. Department of Justice, one of the things that I do as the co-director of this training program is we have developed a policy review scorecard. So when an agency receives federal funding, one of the first things they have to do is they send their administrative policy to my team, and we review the policy. And our scorecard is very extensive. We rate policies on more than 40 different issues. And the way this funding program is structured, an agency that gets a grant can access 10% of their money right away. But they can't get the other 90% of their money until they go through our vetting process and have their administrative policy approved.
And is your vetting process focused on the police response, or is it focused on the community's response?
I mean, there's an entire section of the scorecard that deals with policy development.
Uh-huh.
And there are some of the 40-plus issues are mandatory. They must be covered, and some are optional. And basically, an agency has to get an 80% or higher on this scorecard to have their policy approved, but they have to get 17 out of 17 on the mandatory items. One of the mandatory items is that the department engage the community and external stakeholders in a collaborative process as they're developing their policy.
Okay, so I got a good one for you.
All right, fire away.
Okay, so our city council fast-forwarded a new police contract, and as part of the resolution that adopted that new contract, they made two deals with the police union. One was that police officers would get to review body cam footage before having to write their written reports. The second is that they would be able to review any footage available if they were called into court or had some court proceeding associated with any actions as a police officer. However, the city has not adopted a body-worn camera policy yet. And so these two pieces have been negotiated already with the union, but now the police department says, well, yeah, now let's have a public conversation about developing a policy around body cams. So my question to you is, would that pass the sniff test with the DOJ, the fact that this negotiation has already been affirmed for the next 4 years, but now, after they've negotiated this as part of the union contract, now we're going to go out and talk to the community about developing a policy? Because quite frankly, what can the public do now that those two, the main components of body camera policy, have already been pre-negotiated with the union?
Yeah, you know, the policy development process is critically important. You know, one of the things I often point out is people will always remember Ferguson, Missouri. They'll always remember the name Michael Brown.
Right.
And that officer was not wearing a body camera during that encounter in August of 2014. But what happened was the department, within a month, I think it was 28 days after the death of Michael Brown, those officers began wearing body-worn cameras in the
right.
Ferguson Police Department. And I think that was a tremendous risk, because there is simply no way that department went through the proper planning process, was collaborative with the community,
right.
with external advocacy groups, and with, you know, internal units in the department in a way that ensures that the officers would be able to use those cameras in an effective way. The fact of the matter is the process has to be it has to be deliberate, and it has to be collaborative. You know, I'm looking at our scorecard right now, and one of the items in red is, were community and advocacy groups involved in policy development? If the answer is no, then that policy is not going to pass. It's not going to pass muster.
So, you know, everything's going to depend on how they write that, because they're going to invite us to come and help them develop a policy. But if the two big major policy decisions have already been decided, what's the community going to talk about? What color are they? What side of their vest they wear it on? I mean, what's the policy left to decide?
Well, I think, you know, there are a number of other issues that are addressed in a policy that are important for the community. And, you know, in many ways, just the opportunity to express views and ask questions and to state your point of view is enough. They now, you know, the department now knows how you feel and what you think, and they can kind of incorporate as...
Oh, Dr. White, I got to tell you, no, that is certainly not enough. You're not, it's not enough because you can't invite people to help you develop a policy that you've already decided. Right. And so I totally disagree with you. I as in this community, we've been asked our opinion and then it's been ignored because, again, Exhibit A is the behind closed door negotiation with the union. Right. But they will. I know they will. I know they'll be writing a grant to the federal government. I know they'll be saying we've been talking to the community. We're engaging the community. But the fundamental flaw is that you're only going to hear one side of the story. Unless you're actually out talking to community members who've been engaged in police reform, you won't know if the story you're hearing is accurate. We've got a couple of callers on the line, so we're going to go back there. Good morning, Mitch. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you make 2 points with your guest, and I wanted to remind listeners that when you talk about the accountability issue in the use of body cameras, because this was rolled out as a panacea for making corrupt institutions overnight honest, the loss of the main reason for the body camera, which is the institutional accountability,
yes.
You're very right to keep going back to that. That is the first thing that gets jettisoned, and that's no longer the purpose of the body cam.
Right. Now they're to help police write reports, right.
That's one. Two, the other great point you make that also has to be kept being repeated because news coverage tends to leave these subtleties out is the smell test, the way you put it, which I see also as an issue of public trust in the institution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since what we have is situations around the country of institutional corruption for different sets of reasons, I wanted to ask your guest, when he was reviewing the situation in New York, which is very different than the situation in Ferguson, even though they both manifested in institutional corruption. Yeah. In Ferguson, the city simply didn't have money, and the largely black community was the way that the city was going to gain their revenue,
right,
by continuing to nickel and dime people with unfair traffic violations and stuff, the very people who couldn't afford it, you know, but that was their source of revenue. In New York, it was very different. In New York, you had the mayor, Rudy Giuliani, and I don't know if the public even realizes that Donald Trump has dropped this valuable asset to his campaign as being considered for a cabinet post. And I started asking around, why is Rudy Giuliani out of the picture when he seemed to play such a hero's role? And he's going, Mitch, you're forgetting how much corruption he was involved in as his two terms of mayor. One of the things he was in corruption, he was
I'm
going
to have to wrap you up.
Well, I just want your guest to address the role of whistleblowers in the New York Police Department, specifically Adrian Schoolyard. Not because the New York Times broke the story, because the Village Voice broke the story, and because This American Life took it national, that a police officer...
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you off again. Let's just have Dr. White respond. Otherwise, we'll run out of time, and he'll never get to his answer.
Yeah, there are a couple of things I could say. First, you know, the caller's point on you know, body-worn cameras not being a panacea, that's absolutely accurate. You know, body-worn cameras are a tool. They're a tool that can be used for evidence. They're a tool that can be used for transparency and accountability. But body-worn cameras don't trump bad policy, bad training, and bad supervision.
No.
If you have those kinds of things in your police department, there's not a whole lot that's going to improve just by the addition of body-worn cameras. And if you look at the caller's other question about New York, and the comparison between New York and Ferguson, he's right. You know, in Ferguson, there was a clear focus on generating revenue and targeting the poor, mostly minority community, in order to generate that revenue. The U.S. Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, did an investigation, and that's more or less the conclusion that they came to. In New York, it was first Giuliani and then Bratton, but then the next mayor and commissioner, Ray Kelly is the police commissioner, and Mayor Bloomberg, they continue to use the the kind of mass surveillance stop and frisk program that I describe in the book, they continue to use that despite heavy criticism, despite the litigation. And their argument was that the reason that crime is low in New York and stays low is because we're doing stop and frisk. Right. If we stop using stop and frisk, crime will increase. And they made that case for years. And so it wasn't about revenue. It was their belief that that the crime was staying low in New York City in large part because of what they were doing with stop and frisk in those concentrated areas. And I mentioned in 1991 there were 2,000 homicides in New York City.
Right.
You know, in the last couple of years there's been under 400. So there clearly has been a long-term decline in crime, and they made the case that stop and frisk was a part of that. But what's been clear is since stop and frisk has declined considerably and crime has not increased, that perhaps their argument wasn't accurate.
Well, and that's the same argument that's used for gang enforcement units and for other enhanced police tactics. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we hear that all the time here. Well, we have to have 10 police officers pull one person over who might be selling drugs or part of a gang, right? We have to do that, and we have to look like we're headed to war because it keeps the officers safer, right? Not understanding that this has a impact, a psychological and mental impact on the community that they are impacting. We have another caller on the line. Good morning, Richard. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to ask your guest if he could say a few words about the militarization of the police department.
Ah, excellent. Excellent
question. And how it fits into what you just said, actually, war.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point raised by the caller, and a number of people have talked about this over the last several years, how, you know, for police to do their job well, they need a partnership with the community. Police cannot deal with crime alone. It's a partnership between police and community, and over the years, as some departments have became increasingly militarized, that has put tremendous strain on the relationship between police and the community. And, you know, there was a federal funding program, I forget the name of the program now, where police departments could purchase at very, very low cost military equipment, you know, tanks and assault rifles, and in some cases these were good purchases like body armor and things like that. But, you know, why does a department of 10 officers out in the middle of, you know, of Kansas need a tank?
Right.
And
well,
so
Ferguson got one, right?
Right. And the images from Ferguson, I think, really drove home the problems with that militarization, where you see officers with sniper rifles pointed at protesters, and you see tanks, and there's been a clear move back from that. One of the things President Obama did is that he created a president's task force on 21st century policing, and this was a blue ribbon commission that that held hearings and heard testimony from dozens of citizens and academics and experts. And this was in late 14, early 2015, and that task force issued a report in May of last year with more than 60 recommendations for reforming policing and for building trust between police and minority communities. And that report now serves as a blueprint for how we should move forward, and it does address the issue of militarization and how departments need to step back from that. And believe me, there are times where, you know, police officers need military equipment. I think the Dallas example from earlier this year where officers were being ambushed, that's a perfect example, but it can't be part of routine day-to-day policing.
Absolutely true. I could talk to you for the next couple of hours, Dr. White, but clearly our time is coming to an end. And so I guess for me, I have a couple of like real basic questions. So your book, your premises is that stop and frisk in and of itself is not necessarily a poor policing policy. However, everything is about how it's trained, how it's used, and whether or not it's like the fallback position or whether it's something that's used in a very targeted way. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate.
Okay. Any surprises as you were doing this research? Anything that you just went, what?
Well, I think, you know, we talk about New York and the New York litigation in the stop and frisk case. One of the things that I was a little bit surprised by was how other departments across the country had adopted this kind of this mass surveillance kind of stop and frisk.
Yes.
that New York had really invented. We saw it in Chicago, we saw it in Baltimore, but even in some small cities, Miami Gardens, Florida, a small town in northern suburbs of Miami, adopted this kind of program, and all of those agencies experienced the same kind of problems that the NYPD experienced in terms of tension with the minority community, in terms of a litigation against the department for discriminatory policing. So, I think the key is to you have to avoid that kind of mass surveillance kind of stop and frisk program. It's not what it was designed for. If you go back and you read the Terry case, mm-hmm. it was basically giving officers authority on an individual basis to investigate potential criminal activity. It was never designed to be used as a kind of an invasion of low-income minority communities so that police can routinely stop people without reasonable suspicion. It's just not how it was intended. It morphed into that in New York and other places, and that kind of strategy just is not what we should be doing in 21st century policing.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. I want to thank you very much again for spending time with me today. I've been speaking with Michael D. White. He's a professor at the University of Arizona. And his book, Stop and Frisk, The Use and Abuse of a Controversial Policing Tactic, is extremely informative. There's a lot of good information inside. And I thank you very much. Dr. White, have a great holiday. And I'll look forward to talking to you next year because I will have more questions.
Okay. Thanks, Joanne.
Thanks
for having me on.
You're very welcome. Have a great day. And I just want our listeners to know what's coming up this morning on The Boo at 9 is Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program hosted by Teresa Mitchell. At 10 on Flashpoint with Dennis Bernstein, Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon says the phony blame Putin movement is being fostered by the Clinton Democrats. At 11, Between the Covers, welcome Amy S. Foster, author of The Rife Uprising. Tune in to hear her thoughts about military deception, treatment of immigrants, and the bewildering new adult genre popping up in bookstores. We want to thank KBOO members for your generous support and remind you that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year, thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shedding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate, and it will be that simple. Next week, I will be providing you with a list of actions and activities that you can get involved in starting in January. So if you have any marches, events, actions that you want people to get plugged into, send them my way. Go to Facebook, Voices from the Edge, post what's coming up, time, date, locations, and I will make sure to share that. We want to make sure that as people enjoy this holiday season, that you breathe, but then you come back in January ready to kick butt and take names. We got a lot of work to do, but we are the people to do it, and I'm really excited about the potential of what 2017 is going to provide for us. I know people think I'm crazy when I say I'm excited, but guess what? The most extraordinary things happen in the most and the most interesting times. And we are certainly in interesting times, and great things are in our future, but they're only in our future if we are active and involved and engaged. And that's what we need to, that's what we've been doing. That's what we'll continue to do. And that's one of the reasons why KBOO is so critical now more than ever. And so if you've been thinking about what am I going to do with those last pieces of money that I've got left, maybe you want to give it to KBOO. See you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Hope you have an absolutely fabulous day. And Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, all that good stuff. Talk to you soon. Thanks, John.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand stand up for your rights.
Good morning. It's 8:58, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, your weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program. Portland weather, patchy fog before a little bit more before 10 o'clock, and then a 40% chance of rain today after 1, with a high near 43. It's 8:58.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday nights, midnight to 3 a.m. Sounds Unsound. Sounds Unsound. Sounds Unsound. Only on KBOO. Sound. Tune in every second and fourth Saturday nights, midnight to 3 a.m. Sounds Unsound. Sounds Unsound. Sounds Unsound. Only on KBOO.
Sound. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is the Press Watch General Strike Update. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for news you're not supposed to know and left opinion.